You're listening to Upfront on KPFA. I'm Antonia Yuhas. Tonight, a powerful film airs at the New Parkway Theater in Oakland. It's called The Feminist on Cell Block Y. And it tells the story of a group of inmates at the all-male Soledad prison who founded a program for fellow inmates challenging toxic masculinity and patriarchy. The group is called Success Stories, and its co-founder and a lead organizer joins us today. Richard Reseda Edmund Vargas is able to join us by phone because he was just recently released from prison about a month ago. Richard will also be at tonight's film launch at the New Parkway Theater. The film was directed by Contessa Gales and produced by Emma Lacey Bordeaux. It's a CNN documentary that was released on CNN's digital platform in April. Thanks so much for being with us today, Richard.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So the entire film takes place at the correctional training facility commonly referred to as Soledad State Prison. It's located about 5 miles north of Soledad, California. So Richard, can you help carry our listeners to this prison, how you got there, and then what it's like to be an inmate there?
Yeah. When I was about 12 years old, I started feeling like the pressures of patriarchy and what I was supposed to be as a man kind of started closing in on me and becoming clear to me. And at that time, I believed that to truly be a man, I had to fulfill the hyper-violent stereotypes of what black men are and the black men who I've seen on TV and in music videos and on the corners where I grew up. So I started acting that out, and that looked like doing drugs, selling drugs, hanging out with gang members, being in the streets. There was a brief period of time when I was about 14 and a half till I was 16 where I was in a kind of a youth diversion program where they trained us as community organizers as a way to help us help the community and to change our lives. But unfortunately, I went back to the life after doing that for a short time. I robbed 2 stores when I was 19 years old, and I was sentenced to 10 years in prison after serving about a year in the county jail and a year at a high security California state prison. I was transferred to Soledad, which is a medium security state prison.
Okay. And how long were you at Soledad before you founded the group? And tell us a little bit about what your life was like there before the founding of the group.
So I wasn't there very long before we started the group. I got to Soledad in August of 2013. And by October 2013, Charles Berry, the co-founder of Success Stories, and I were doing the research and putting together the curriculum for what would become Success Stories. How that happened was, first, I think it's important to say that high security prisons in California, at least when I was in them in 2012 and 2013, had virtually no programming. They were very violent places where you did most of the time in lockdown. And when you did come out, it would just be to go to yard for a couple of days or weeks or months before there was another riot or some form of violence, and then everybody would be locked down again. So for my first two, and LA County Jail is even worse. So for my first 2 years incarcerated, I was trying desperately to get into college. I was trying desperately to be a part of anything positive, and it just wasn't happening. When I got to Soledad, I had the opposite experience. Soledad was like nothing. I never knew a prison could be this way in that. One, I think it's important to point out that most of the population there were older lifers who had been down 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, and just wanted to go home and have built lives for themselves, fulfilling lives for themselves in prison. So the culture in Soledad was very different. It was significantly less violent, and there were a lot of these self-help groups they were all founded and ran by incarcerated people, even if they were using curriculums like established curriculums or they were groups that you've heard of in other places, they were still being led by incarcerated people. So when I got there, people started inviting me to go to these groups, and I went, and I was happy to go. But I started noticing that the solutions that they were offering in a lot of these groups did not challenge patriarchy. They kind of offered traditional American patriarchy as the solution. They were saying, just don't break the law. Don't be a gang member. But you should, you know, run your household. And they still, you know, albeit not in this language, they're still implying that our value as men came from our ability to control situations, control others, specifically women and children, and by our ability to earn money, albeit now legally, but still, you're not a real man unless you can make money. So I, you know, my kind of transformation or was, like I said, when I was very young, my the first attempt that anybody made to kind of bring me out of my addiction and harmful behavior was always through a radical feminist lens. And then when I went to prison, the people who were supporting me and sending me books when I couldn't get into any programs, when those programs weren't available, all I had were my family and my community, my wife Taina, my mentor Patrice, my mentor Mark Anthony, my best friend Haywan. And what they were sending me were books that were also based in radical feminism and offered radical feminism as a solution for a wholesome way of living for men. So being in these groups that they had at Soledad, I just felt like they were inherently problematic and that they were kind of leading people to fail. I grew up in a household where my dad didn't do drugs or gangbang or anything like that. He worked two jobs and he never broke the law. He didn't drink, he didn't smoke, he didn't have any tattoos. And yet I still grew up in a violent household, a household that was ran by patriarchal violence, where my dad had the final say in everything, and where, you know, mental, emotional, and even physical violence took place. So I knew that what they were saying in these groups wasn't the answer. I tried to my first attempt was I did this patriarchy workshop where I just got bell hooks, We Real Cool, and A Will to Change, and made a 45-minute presentation out of it. And I asked these groups, hey, can I do this presentation? And, you know, I got played to the left. They didn't, the guys who ran the groups kind of, you know, jerked me around, laughed at me, whatever. When I finally got somebody to let me do it in front of their groups, they cut my time down to like 15, 20 minutes and guys were laughing. It went terrible. And I came back from that experience and I went up to Charles and I said, man, we got to start our own group.
You actually take us into your cell in the film and you show us a place of honor on your wall where you have pictures of your heroes. How did these women arrive as your heroes?
They're all in different ways. Bell Hooks' work was back when I did enter that program, the Summer Youth Organizing Academy, where I was being trained as an organizer. I also, just being in that world of community organizers in Los Angeles, I was invited to participate in so many other things, like these men's groups, these like feminist men's groups that were happening in LA at the time. And they were bringing me in as a 14-year-old kid. And that's the kind of stuff we were reading. And I remember being around these men, and when I would come in, they would hug me, which was weird to me. I wasn't used to hugging men. And they didn't give me like the patriarchal back pat when they hugged me. They like really hugged me and held my shoulders and looked me in the eyes and said, thank you for being here, and showed me I was valued here. And I seen how they interacted with each other and how they processed their feelings, how they were honest about their feelings. And I knew even then when I was 14, like these guys have found, this is like the way to live. Now, obviously, it wasn't enough to keep me. I was still committed to living how I wanted to live, and I didn't stay. But, you know, a lot of what the way that these men were living in these groups were coming out of the books they were reading, and the books they were reading were by bell hooks. So when I got to prison and I started reading through these books again now as a young adult, and seeing the freedom that she was offering from this world that I lived in, that, you know, was even more magnified in prison, this world of patriarchal violence, I just kind of couldn't help but exalt her as somebody. She freed me.
You do say that once you started Success Stories, there was pushback, and we see some of that in the film. Many of the men, it seems, speak ultimately as is discussed in the film, from a position of fear of what it would mean to be outside and not be leading through patriarchal and toxic masculine attitudes and frameworks, fear for what it would mean for their sons to be in the world following a different model. Can you talk about what it was like to face that fear from the other inmates and then overcoming it through success stories?
I mean, it was a process, right? Because first I had to face that fear within myself. The way that prison exists, at least in California, is that there is a whole culture within prisons that's very similar to the culture within gangbanging on the streets, where your value is determined by your patriarchy in a way that's way more concentrated than it is not in the streets. Or not in prison. And by that I mean, like, you're standing, and if you're seen as quote unquote good, or if you're seen as bad news, somebody who can't even be around, somebody who can be beat up at any moment and sent off the yard and not allowed to even program by the other incarcerated people, is all based on how patriarchally you've dealt with certain situations. So I'll give you an example. In California prisons and jails, if I land in a cell, and you know, the cops put you in whatever cell is open, I land in a cell, and for whatever reason, I can't be in that cell. Maybe it's because me and my cellie don't get along. Maybe it's because where he's from. Maybe it's because of his race. For whatever reason, I cannot be in that cell. I'm not allowed by the kind of patriarchal rules that govern these places, I'm not allowed to just tell the cops, put me in another cell. Mm-hmm. That would be seen as what they call the PC move, or when you rely on the cops to deal with your problems for you. What I'm supposed to do is go in that cell, fight that man, so therefore the cops are forced to move me. Those are the kind of rules that govern these places, where you're just forced to just make the most violent, patriarchal, self-destructive decisions at all times. If I know that a riot's going to happen on the yard, I'm required to come out of my cell. If I do not come out of my cell and put myself in harm's way where I can be stabbed or shot and killed by the cops, I'm then considered bad news. And at any given time, I can be jumped and sent off the yard. Then I arrive at another yard and they're like, how'd you get here? Why are you here? And eventually it will come out, just because there's only so many people in prison, hey, he got removed because he wasn't in a riot, or because he rolled it up out of a cell, which is like the colloquial way of saying, I left the cell without first fighting. I asked for the cops' help. So these rules and you know, the list goes on, govern every interaction in prison. So to challenge patriarchy in prison is to challenge these rules. And our safety is so interconnected with how well we follow these rules. First I had to, it took a long time for me to be willing to challenge patriarchy because I was terrified. I was terrified not only of the violence that would happen to me, but I was sentenced to 10 years with 2 strikes for these robberies when I was 19. So if I participate in any violence for the rest of my life, I get life in prison under California law. So I'm terrified of pushing any envelope that could lead someone to attack me, and then I defend myself, and then I get life. But eventually I had to get to a point where I was like, look, there's so much madness going on. I got to be willing to either go to the dirt for this madness that I don't believe in, possibly risk my freedom for this madness that I don't believe in, or my life for this madness I don't believe in, or I got to be willing to risk that freedom or that safety for something I do believe in. And that was a very difficult decision to make. And it took, you know, I was in prison for a couple of years before I was willing to make it. Because at first I was participating to the same level as everybody else. I got in 5 fights within my first 6 months of being incarcerated. Yeah. So anyway, I had to go through it first. Then when we started building the programs to get other people to do it, you know, just kind of on my own immaturity and not lack of self-awareness, lack of experience, I was expecting everyone to do it so quickly, because what I realized was most of it was in my head. And once I started challenging it, yeah, there were people who would make jokes. There was a couple people who tried to get violent or whatever, but I hadn't been jumped yet. I hadn't been stabbed yet. So I started realizing that it's not as scary as I thought, and that a lot of it's in my head. Not to say that nothing ever happens, because it definitely does. But once I realized that most of it was in my head, then I was like, oh, okay, let's start a whole program and everybody can do it.
Do you mean in your head that it was myths that if you didn't participate in these rules as they were handed down to you, that there would be a terrible outcome, that that was myths that were told to keep people in check, and that once you did, or if this is correct, sort of stand aside at these moments and not engage in the violence, that then the negative consequences didn't manifest?
So it wasn't complete. They were not completely myths. Mm-hmm. People do get jumped and stabbed for not participating in riots all the time, mm-hmm. or for rolling it up out of a cell all the time. That really does happen. But what I realized I was doing was taking everything to the extreme. Mm-hmm. So in a moment where, 'cause something else that happens in jail is where you can get jumped or stabbed is if you let somebody call you the B word, let somebody call you anything that relates you to a woman or a queer person. You're supposed to fire on them immediately, or your homies or the people from your area or your gang will then, you know, what they call deal with you later. So because of those things, I was afraid to challenge people when they would refer to women as the B word. Mm-hmm. I was afraid to challenge people when they would say negative things about queer folks. But what I started realizing when I did finally get the courage to do it is that just because I challenged those things when people said it didn't necessarily mean they were going to turn around and be like, well, what are you know, are you a B? Are you a F? And now I'm in this situation where I got to fight them. Right. So it was that's what I mean when I said a lot of it was in my head. I could challenge somebody and be like, bro, why you talk so bad about gay people, though? Without them necessarily turning on me, and now I'm being in this situation where I feel like I have to fight. And then the next step was when I did start finding myself in situations where dudes were in my face, you know, punching their palm, trying to fight. There were other ways to deal with it. Mm. Like, bro, like, you really mad right now, and I'd rather talk to you and we can have this conversation more calmly. I hear where you're coming from. I just disagree, and spin off. And I didn't even know that that was a possible way to react at first. And it was just, you know, it happened slowly but surely. So that's not to say that I want to be really clear that prison politics is a real thing and that people are afraid for real reasons, but there's much more fluidity and nuance available to us that we cut off out of fear.
So is your experience then, once you started living these lessons of challenging toxic masculinity, patriarchal violence, that there was another path that you could actually walk the talk from the group?
Yeah, we kind of had to make it.
Yeah.
Because everybody I knew who was not directly participating in this culture usually did it from a perspective of religion. Oh, I'm a Christian, so I don't get down like that. And there's like a lane for them in prison. Like, okay, we know the Christians don't live this way. And, you know, from prison to prison, it may be accepted, it may be not. But for the most part, it at least there is a lane there. But the lane of I'm a feminist, or I am nonviolent in my practices, those kinds of things didn't exist. That's stuff that we had to kind of create that lane in prison. And when I say we, I mean myself and the other early Success Stories facilitators.
So tell us about Success Stories and what you did in the curriculum. And I know it continues on even after you've now left prison. And mm-hmm. What worked and what continued to be a challenge?
So it took a minute to get it right. The first, like I mentioned, the first patriarchy workshops pre-Success Stories were a disaster. when we started Success Stories in February of 2014, you know, Success Stories covers a lot. We talk about entrepreneurship, we talk about responsible thinking, we talk about accountability, like all these other things. But a big part of it is this unit that we do on patriarchy. And the first time we did a patriarchy workshop, we just took some excerpts out of We Real Cool by Bell Hooks. We broke into our small groups. Each small group kind of read it, popcorn read it or whatever. And then we had a series of discussion questions after. And these ones didn't go great, mostly because I didn't realize how big of an undertaking it was to train the facilitators to represent this topic well. I figured if you could talk about accountability and you can talk about personal responsibility, you can talk about patriarchy, but the healing work and the, changing of the thinking and the getting out of the fear and all the stuff I had to go through for the first couple years I was incarcerated before we started this program, I didn't give them the opportunity to go through that. I was just like, here's a curriculum, do your thing. So it wasn't working. It wasn't working. I was getting a lot of pushback from facilitators, pushback from participants, and then facilitators were not, pushing back to their pushback. They're just like, yeah, you're right, but whatever, I'm just supposed to tell you this. So then after a couple times doing it that way, we then reached out to these college students who are at a local university, they're at Cal State Monterey Bay. Their names were Janice and Chris, and they had a feminist like club at the college. And we knew them through my wife Taina, and we asked them to come in and do our patriarchy workshop. So they came in and did a couple of them. And those were better, but we still weren't connecting with people. And we weren't getting the results that you see in the film. Then until the next time we tried it, by this time we had, the organization had been around for a couple years. We had a really strong leadership team. And one of our directors named Chris Johnson, he was like telling me, like, bro, you need to get up there and don't teach people about patriarchy. Process your patriarchy in front of other people so that they will relate with you. And not, he was like, this is not a teacher-student moment. He said, that's not how you became the feminist that you are today. Someone didn't sit there and teach it to you, and then you started doing it. You had to process through your own stuff. And that moment was kind of the changer for us. So that's when we changed over to the patriarchy workshop that's shown in the film, where first we put up people talking about processing through their own patriarchy. In the film, we showed 88. His first name is James. Everyone calls him 88. Talking about how he was locked up with the dude who murdered his brother.
It's a powerful moment in the
Yeah,
film.
yeah. And he talks about that. Roy got up there and talked about how he used women in high school for his own self-image. So we started doing that first. Then I would come out and do kind of the, what is patriarchy piece that was shown in the film. And then we would put everybody who shared their stories along with me or whoever does that instructional piece, because I don't do it anymore, but we have teams of folks who are trained to do so. They all sit up on a panel and do like a Q&A conversation thing. And then we come back the next week, and the next week everyone has further discusses it in small groups and kind of has the opportunity to process through their own stuff now that it's clear on what it is we're talking about. And once we did that, then we started getting the results. We started getting a lot more, I don't want to say conversion, but a lot more people who understood what we were saying it and what we were saying and saw it beneficial to apply it to their own lives.
I mean, what I found pretty remarkable, it seemed to me just based on the stories that the different participants were telling. And again, to remind our listeners, the film we're talking about is The Feminist on Cell Block Y. It's playing tonight at the New Parkway Theater at 6:30 p.m. Our guest, Richard Reseda Edmund Vargas, will be there tonight as well. It seemed that many of the men, when they were telling their stories, who were part of the group, inmates at Soledad Prison, were incarcerated for committing murders, and that we're talking about men who have participated in one of the most extreme forms of violence that we can engage in as humans, and being asked to go through the process of seeing that through the lens of critiquing their, very sense of how they understand their manhood, as this as the discussion of the film puts forward, that is intensely toxic, masculine, and patriarchal. And how hard is it to be in that room when that process is happening?
It took me it after a while, it wasn't hard anymore. At first it was. Because emotions are just running so high, and it's such a paradigm shift. Like trying to see patriarchy when you are a cis man who was raised in it is like trying to see water when you're a fish. It's just reality. You don't even see what's happening around you. So to get guys to see it, there was like a lot of pushback. Sometimes it would get personal. People would get, verbally violent, get in your face. So it was hard at first until, we kind of realized that that's just part of it, and we stopped taking it personal, and we realized that this is just that moment, like in the Matrix when they first plug them up and they like wig out at first, like it's just gonna happen. And then once we weren't taking it personal anymore and we came to expect it, then we can also treat them with more patience and love and understanding and know they're just going through what we went through, and it became a lot less difficult.
What are the points when men would really get upset in that way, would really get in your face, would get angry?
When there's like a direct challenge to their behavior. So it's one thing to talk about my experience or to give some kind of instruction on feminist theory, but it's another thing to say to somebody, this particular behavior isn't cool. So, for example, we had a moment where back when we were doing the patriarchy workshops, working with Janice and Chris, where Janice was talking about her experience, and she said she was talking about street harassment and not wanting sexual attention from men every time she walks out of the house. And one of our participants raised his hand and said, "Well, isn't there such thing as free speech?" And she responded by saying, "Sure, there's such thing as free speech. I could use my free speech to insult you, but does that make it okay?" And he actually, and now, and she like made a joke, like I could use my free speech and say that the tattoo on your face looks stupid, but that doesn't make it okay. And in that moment, not only was his behavior being challenged, but kind of that masculine pride was being challenged of a woman saying that to him in front of all these men. He like flared up to the point where we had to intervene. He wasn't going to hit her or anything like that, I don't think so, but he started with the posturing and the fists and the yelling and what we're all kind of familiar with what men are trained to do when we're being challenged, and we had to intervene in that. Another example is when I was talking to a facilitator in a facilitator training, and he kept saying, "We can't tell these dudes not to do this stuff, man. You're gonna have these guys, putting them in harm's way." And I said, "Bro, you're thinking like a victim." And the word victim in prison is very sensitive because a victim is somebody who gets attacked or who gets raped or who gets jacked. And he got in my face like, "I ain't never a victim. I ain't never a victim." Like so close to my face, like centimeters away from my nose, and like trying to get me to hit him. So those are kind of the moments, like when we really hit those buttons, and we're directly talking about somebody's thinking or actions. That's when we would get the more violent responses.
And did you then also see the positive responses playing out? People, as the show in the film, living a life of integrity being a key message of moving away from toxic masculinity, seeing the processes of what is learned through the program being implemented.
Yeah, that was probably the most awesome. Those are the moments that we as organizers and people who do cultural work live for. Because I would see guys who would go through the workshop and then, pull me aside, or especially when I was still facilitating and I had a small group, guys pull me aside and say, "Man, I never thought about it like this. And I talked to my little brother about this. I talked to my kid about this. Like, this has really helped me." And something really cool that happened recently was Craig, who is in the film. He offers a lot of pushback in the film. He's the one who is saying, "I can't just talk about my mama loves me and I'm getting beat up at school saying my mama loves me, my mama loves me." He is now out of prison, and I guess after I had transferred away from the prison, he became a facilitator and one of our lead facilitators in the patriarchy work. I talked to him the other day on the phone. He said that it changed his life, that he's having these conversations with all the men in his life, and he just feels like, he said, success stories freed me. So those are, I mean, you know, those are those moments where you just can't help but feel it in your heart.
That's fantastic. I have so many more questions that I would want to ask you, but we've run out of time. But fortunately, listeners can ask you themselves in person tonight by showing up at the New Parkway Theater at 6:30. Our guest, Richard Reseda Edmund Vargas, will be there. The film is The Feminist on Cell Block Y. If you can't come tonight, you can also look up Richard's group, which he and his wife Taina started, which is called Initiate Justice. And is there a website for that, Richard?
Yes, it's initiatejustice.org, and that is our organization to do prison policy work.
Fantastic. So look up more there. Watch the film. If you can't come tonight, it's on CNN. You can find it. It's a CNN documentary directed by Contessa Gales, produced by Emma Lacey Bordeaux. Thanks again so much for joining us, Richard Reseda Edmund Vargas. Richard, this was a great conversation and a great film, and congratulations on no longer being in jail.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
And thanks for all your great work. Thanks for being with us.